I enjoy interviews because something different can happen between two people that cannot happen without us being in conversation.
Conversations in the Arts and Humanities introduces you to the people and passions of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities at Vancouver Island University and shares stories about events and projects happening on campus. My name's Theo Finnegan, and I'm talking to Magnolia Porker from Studies in Women and Gender at VIU. Friday, November 22nd, from 10 till 11:30 in the Malaspina Theatre, Magnolia will give a presentation titled Philosophy Now, Genealogies of Philosophical Journalism and the Question of the Present. This talk will look at the genre of the interview, including its capacity for critical intervention and invention through the lens of the French philosopher Michel Foucault. Magnolia Porker is Professor in Studies in Women and Gender at VIU and lecturer in the Faculty of Culture and Community at Emily Carr University.
My earliest interest in interview that I can recall at the moment is playing Barbara Walnuts in the bathtub as a child. So I had a great love of comedy and interviews and imagined myself in the role of interviewer, but not too seriously all the way along. I've always been a lover of questions and wanting to bring those questions forward in all kinds of different ways. So my academic trajectories are multiple. I grew up on Salt Spring Island, on the territories of the San Coatlin speaking people. And I grew up in the 80s and 90s feeling a little at odds with my community, and always reaching for other community through reading. And it was through my love of books and reading that I learned that there were other worlds, and oftentimes that the problems that I was encountering weren't me, that there would be other people who wanted to critique status quo. And I found those through conversation and through interview. So I took a program at the University of King's College in Halifax, where I completed a kind of great works of Western literature, history, sociology, etc. program, and then got into a contemporary studies program. And contemporary studies is probably my main foundation for thinking interview and drawing journalism and philosophy together as not as two strands of an approach, but as an approach where journalism is philosophy. Philosophy is journalism.
What was an example of a book that did that for you when you were younger?
One of the earliest books I remember personally was a book by Mildred D. Taylor called Let the Circle Be Unbroken, from the perspective of a young African-American girl, Cassie. Such a beautiful book and a difficult book. It's devastating because it takes place in the American South during segregation. And also just utterly heartening in terms of the humanity and the care that is demonstrated by very young people. Mm-hmm. And, right, in very difficult, to me, unimaginable circumstances.
In your bio for the colloquium, there's a really fascinating phrase where you refer to yourself as an undisciplined scholar and theorist. And I wanted to ask you about the word undisciplined, because if we take sort of a standardized view of scholarship, discipline is so crucial, right?
Like
the disciplines we are in,
totally.
The discipline we bring to our work.
Totally.
And so can you talk about your intervention with that word?
So I'm following the intervention of Sarah Schulman. who uses this text to refer, or the notion of the undisciplined scholar to refer to her own work, and particularly in the book Conflict is Not Abuse, where she's looking at how often when people engage in various conflicts on micro levels and macro levels, the ones who kind of trouble the norm get are often accused as being abusers. So she uses different examples within her life as a teacher, and then also she uses the example of Israel and Palestine. And she talks about how we need to be having these really difficult conversations, and we need to learn how to engage in conflict in ways that acknowledge our relationality. And so rather than just cutting someone off and being finished with them because we disagree or because we've been hurt, finding ways to actually have the conversations around what happened and to try for some form of repair is the prompt there. In terms of, she refers to herself as undisciplined as a scholar because she's not really working from within a disciplinary, right? Context. I've always struggled with how to define my disciplinarity. because right from the outset, my undergrad degree was combined honors in history and contemporary studies. And I wasn't ever quite sure where I fit. And I really didn't fit anywhere. And then I went on from that to take a master's in history at U of T. And I went in, you know, studying histories of oppression and particularly around the Holocaust and the genocide of, in Europe perpetrated by Nazis against Jews and homosexuals and intellectuals, disabled folks. And as I was learning and looking at the way that discipline was formed, I started to need to go outside the discipline to look at what was happening in the present time. That was the time of Holocaust denial in Canada. And Ernst Sundel made a kind of appearance on the world stage as the largest purveyor of Holocaust denial at that time. And I walked by his compound of neo-Nazis on my way to school. Wow. Yeah. And I always, I was adopted out of my Jewish family, but I have a Jewish heritage, but I'm very white. So I was often in those times, that was around 2000, but even leading up to that, I had often found myself approached by white skinheads and racists who thought I might join their cause on the street. Mm. And it was always just such a sickening moment to me. I ended up writing about racism in the Canadian media around the Somalia affair, because what I discovered was those neo-Nazis who I was encountering in my life, and also who I was reading about in relationship to, these were the people who were making the pamphlets and denying a genocide. Some of them were actually sent to Somalia as peacekeepers, mm. and that, like, our prime minister at the time had their dossiers on her desk and sent them anyway. Mm. I just could never quite stay within a discipline, which meant that when I finished my master's, my advisors, my supervisors said to me, you got to go figure yourself out. Like, you're not ready to go do a PhD because you don't know what field you're even going to go towards. Mm-hmm. So I, the internet in its fledgling status, mm-hmm. I put the names of Judith Butler and Donna Haraway in and discovered that they both were teaching at the European Graduate School at the time. And so I went and started a philosophy degree there. Coming from a working class family myself, I couldn't even believe I was in this place, Switzerland, in the Alps, mm-hmm. studying with philosophers mm-hmm. who I had dreamed of, you know, and whose work I had read with great love and for several years at that point. And so I decided that I had this amazing opportunity and I was really struggling with the present, and I thought I could ask them what their thoughts were. Mm. because I knew that they were really invested ethically. So that's where my practice of interviewing started, really.
Really?
In a formal way.
Mm-hmm. So you interviewed them?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, that first summer, I got to take a class with Agnès Varda, a French filmmaker. She was from the Left Bank, working alongside the other famous male French filmmakers who are really well known. Mm. But she had just done a really beautiful work called The Gleaners and I that was about cultures of gleaning. Mm. And she was presenting that work at the school at the time. And Judith Butler was there and Donna Haraway was there. And I found them, we were encouraged to just go and talk with them. Mm. Jean-Luc Nancy was there.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. And what was so amazing was how kind they were in response. So I asked them, can I interview you? And the response was yes. And so I asked them, I started my series of interviews, which was on breaking the binary, then in 2003, and asked them about, you know, what does it mean? You're with us or against us. What do we do in these times?
Undisciplined also, to me, made me think of sort of uncategorizable or problems with categories. So Michel Foucault is a bit uncategorizable, I would argue. One of the things you write is that he self-identified as a philosopher journalist, and you mentioned that a bit earlier in our conversation, that the confluence of those two terms. What is that? If we say philosophy journalism, which in common parlance maybe aren't two words that are often put together, obviously in scholarship maybe more so, but what does that mean to bring those two words together?
Foucault, you know, refused to be disciplined and punished. Thank you for setting me up for that. Wow, that was cheesy. My kids would be rolling their eyes, but he refused that. And I don't know why, but in my reading, that refusal is part of a kind of enactment or performance of his philosophical commitments and beliefs. And so there's all kinds of refusals of discipline, right? And certainly, and Foucault, you know, often he's asked, well, are you a structuralist? No, he'll say. Oh, well, then you must be a post-structuralist. No, he'll say. Oh, are you a historian? No. Are you a philosopher? No. And how did you manage to write such brilliant work? He'll say, well, I was the right person at the right time. He'll give you, instead of giving you an answer to how brilliant he was, he'll give you his sort of personal itinerary, which I think is a really interesting way to refuse once again to be disciplined by the question or interpolated into a certain regime of academic and pop culture. Hi, my name is Magnolia Pocker from the Department of Studies in Women and Gender at VIU. You are listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM, Nanaimo.
One way to think of philosophical journalism is a certain embeddedness in the contemporary moment, which I wonder if we might distinguish that from the nowness of, say, conventional journalism or mainstream journalism, which very much emphasizes the contemporary 24-hour news cycle, like what's happening right now, you know, and now we get it streamed to us, you know, on our phones just constantly. So we're constantly in the contemporary in that sense. But I feel like that's not what you mean, that being embedded in the contemporary in a philosophically journalistic way means something quite different. How would you characterize that and maybe the difference between those two things?
I love the way you ask that question. It helps me to think about how the contemporary has sped up and the pace of the contemporary is something different than it was for me even 5 years ago. Right. And certainly growing up, and certainly than it was for Foucault. So the pace and the, I mean, I don't know if we're, can we be like, maybe we're like being blown along by the contemporary rather than embedded. To me, embedded means that we have some kind of foothold.
Right.
And I don't know that we have that in contemporary media ecologies.
I feel like, these are important ideas to talk about now. So today we're, November 8th today, 7th?
Yeah.
Two days after Donald Trump gets elected to go back to the White House.
Yeah.
First time is tragedy, second time is farce or something. I don't know. Maybe both times is tragedy. What does what we're talking about have to tell us about how to think about what has happened in America in the last few weeks, and maybe more importantly, where do we go from here, particularly thinking about the way in which particular communities are under threat, have always been under threat or already been under threat, but even more so now, women, trans people, migrants, people of color. The work that scholars do and journalists do, I think, maybe takes on an even more pointed importance in such a polarized environment politically and socially, which is so evident from, you know, looking at those election maps of down south. Is that part of the necessary response too? That it clearly is not. I've been seeing a lot of responses online from blue state people and Democrats and so on, like, and Facebook pages, right, where people are, you know, understandably devastated. But part of that is sometimes tied to a kind of response that I'm not sure is productive, which is, you know, demonizing, which is kind of the mirror image of the other side, which is understandable. But does, you know, is that really going to lead to the change that needs to happen?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, these are obviously hugely complicated questions and issues, but I wonder if that's one way to think of it, of a response.
I think so. And I think about, you know, one of my strategies teaching is to ask questions. And one of my strategies in difficult conversations is to slow things down by asking questions. And I think that, you know, if I could sit down, if we could sit down, instead of having these kind of pseudo yelling debates, I mean, the debate isn't even a debate anymore in our public cultures. There's like the parameters of what was once a debate are gone. So how then should we have a conversation? And an interview isn't quite a conversation, but that's what we need to be doing, is having conversations. And an interview might be a model for a conversation. I'd say an interview has a purpose in a way that a conversation doesn't always. But I could be convinced otherwise in all kinds of different contexts. But I mean, if we, you know, I would think of Avital Rennell's book on stupidity, which she released in the wake of the Bush administration coming to power. And, you know, she said she takes the figure of stupidity as an opportunity for us to acknowledge that I am stupid before the other. So that when we're sitting here speaking with one another, we actually listen to one another, that we don't assume. And what she says is that if we do that, if we acknowledge our fundamental stupidity in the face of the other, then we could not go to war against what we do not understand. We would have to learn to understand. And that would be where I'd want to, you know, on the one hand go. On the other hand, I'm not willing to engage in mutual conversation with someone who denies the rights of certain people to exist.
Right. That there's, right? There are lines.
There are
that
lines.
Need to be drawn.
Yes.
You call the interview a naturalized form across multiple domains of everyday life. It seems to me that it's even maybe more naturalized now than it has been. I'm thinking particularly of podcasts, which we're talking on right now, also going out on the radio, CHLY. So really ubiquitous form, like almost exponentially so now. What as someone who thinks about the interview, what are your thoughts on podcasts? I might put my cards on the table as someone who does a podcast with with Robin Davies.
Yes, I think the interview is so ubiquitous, and that's why it's so interesting, because it's just an opportunity to study relations of power in a live kind of an ongoing way. It's also, I realize, like, actually everything we do is an interview. I mean, Roland Barthes wrote that the text is a tissue of quotations. I love that quote, and thinking about, like, I mean, my own fleshy tissue is of quotation. And everything is interview. Everything comes from some kind of engagement with another. Entretien is the French word for interview, right? And it means to catch a glimpse of. I also appreciate that prompt for reminding us that we just catch a glimpse through interview. I enjoy interviews because something different can happen between two people that cannot happen without us being in conversation. So I have had different thoughts today as a result of you.
Completely. And, right? And so I have these questions written down, and I talked about many of them, but we talked about a range of things that were not in here.
Exactly.
Right, which is, it enacts something that's not the plan.
Yes. And that's always my hope when I'm the interviewer, is to have done enough work to be able to then go off script. I think it takes such a profound amount of work to do a really engaged interview. And that work might be, like, as I get older and have more to draw from, it comes more easily than it once did. But there are conditions for, you know, what makes possible a critical encounter and interview. So I asked Sat Jali, who is he's a cultural studies theorist, and he does the Media Education Foundation, all of those films and interviews. He was in Vancouver years ago when I interviewed him about the interview, because why not? And I asked him what his conditions were for doing an interview. And he said 20 minutes without a clip, without a cut. And I said, so you've never done an interview with a mainstream news source? Nope, absolutely not.
Because they're so short.
Because what's the point?
Soundbite.
Right? Exactly. And I don't know, maybe all those like shock jocks have given podcasting a bad name too.
Maybe part of it, right? For sure, yeah. But then I was thinking too, one thing I do a lot of is watch YouTube. And there's fuzziness between these genres, right? And there's a guy called Rick Beato who does music interviews and other things too. But one of the main things he does is interview pretty famous musicians. He's got a lot of access to them. But he talks to them for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And there's the odd ad that pops up or whatever. But it's one of the freedoms, or one of the kind of benefits of this kind of ecology we live in, media ecology, I think, is, which on the one hand enables a lot, you know, the kind of shock jock thing and lots of different voices. But you can get these, to your point of 20 minutes, no cut, 90 minutes just talking, that you go to some different places through that.
Totally.
That are not, it's not reducible to, 5 minutes or not even 5 minutes, like a soundbite. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and then there's like really creative and kind of goofy engagements with interview, like Nardwuar, the human serviette.
Can you explain what?
So Nardwuar is an interviewer of musicians as well, and has for many years, based in Vancouver. His interview is often based around a kind of gift con, where he does his research in so well that he'll find these things that the musician who he's in conversation with, that are about their history, right? And he seems to be able to surprise them so profoundly with the depth and capacity of his research that they end up opening up to him in ways that are pretty unexpected. So, and it's funny, and he has a whole kind of a personality shtick that he does as well that's quite different from, you know, your average kind of masculinist music industry engagement. And it is interesting to see those different possibilities.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Magnolia Porker for joining me in conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies, music by Greg Bush. The Colloquium series will be back in 2025 with three more reflective and engaging presentations by Arts and Humanities faculty. For more information, go to ah.viu.ca and click on Colloquium Series. My name's Theo Finnegan. Thanks for listening.